Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. Seems strange, but it's Tuesday, even though it's our first day back at work. Of course, you probably worked yesterday, too, someplace. So this is November 13th, and then on November 15th, am I right? November 15th, yeah, exam number 3. All right, so I want to go over this, and we got an announcement from our SI leader in just a second, but I want everybody to know that the exam next time is going to cover chapters 9, 10, 11, and 12, and not 13. 9, 10, 11, and 12. All right, even though we're going to move into 13 today. So listen up to an important announcement from your SI leader.
Okay, guys, for those of you guys who are here this morning for the first half of the mock exam, for those of you guys who signed up for the mock exam, it's the same mock exam for those of you guys who came this morning. Okay, so for those of you guys who came this morning, you guys don't have to come. Okay, but we'll have a second administration of the mock exam at Business 319 from 1 to 3. Okay, hope to see you guys there. And please, for those people who signed up, to show up. If you guys don't show up, it's fine, but I already have a set number, so I already printed out 20 copies. So the first 20 who come in will get the copies, but then everyone else, I'm sorry, you guys gotta have to just share. Okay? Anyway, hope to see you guys there. Okay, have a good day.
Thank you. All right, so that's the schedule. And maybe I'll turn some of these lights down. I think we ran like that last time. Is it too dark? Well, I hear a lot of comments and enthusiastic comments, but I still can't read if you're really happy or sad about that. Sad. Okay, so I need to turn. No, happy. Like that. That's maybe the best thing. Okay. I don't want anybody to fall asleep. That's why I don't shut up. Okay, so we were talking about muscle last time. All right, but before we start finishing up muscle, don't forget, you got exam 3 coming up on Thursday over 9, 10, 11, and 12. Any questions on something we've covered in lecture so far? You found the study materials in Blackboard, exam figures. I think I was going to put a couple of keys of some exam figures in Blackboard. Maybe I'll do that this evening. There was a tyrosine kinase receptor. Your book has a 3-panel, but the exam figure in your study guide is a 4-panel. And you'll see that basically they're the same. All right, so how many different kinds of muscle are there? Yeah, there's 3 kinds. And what are those 3 kinds? Cardiac, smooth, and skeletal. Which do you have voluntary control over? Skeletal. So we spend most of the time with that because it's very important, because it's the only thing that you do have voluntary control of in your body is skeletal muscle. And can a skeletal muscle ever make up its mind to contract or not? No, it just always does, because the neuromuscular junction is a large system. It always causes a threshold depolarization, and there are voltage-gated channels within the neuromuscular junction, so that always creates an action potential. And that action potential can flow over the whole muscle cell because there are voltage-gated channels. And how does it flow over the whole muscle cell and even down through the transverse tubules? How does it travel? How does an action potential travel? Without decrement, right? So an action potential flows over uniformly, exactly the same way, exciting the whole skeletal muscle. And what ion is necessary to get those myofilaments to slide past each other? Calcium ions, right. And what's the energy source? ATP, right. Okay, and for skeletal muscle, where does the calcium come from? The sarcoplasmic reticulum, yeah, it's intracellular. And don't forget those ryanodine receptors and DHP receptors and calcium-induced release channels in skeletal muscle that just flood the myofibril with calcium when an action potential is on the cell membrane. All right, so there's a little bit of difference between that kind of muscle and cardiac muscle, which is what we have here on the screen. And maybe I'll just go to this kind of projection right here. And you'll see that cardiac muscle is striated if you look at it underneath a microscope. So what does it have that's similar to skeletal muscle? Yeah, it has those striations, but what does that really mean? What's the structural and functional unit of contraction for skeletal and cardiac muscle because it's striated? It has the structural and functional unit for contraction is the sarcomere. So understand everything you can about a sarcomere, and you know everything about how skeletal muscle contracts and cardiac muscle, with a couple little differences. Cardiac muscle does have transverse tubules. Let me get my cursor working properly. All right, it does have transverse tubules. And indeed, there are voltage-gated channels in the cell membrane, so it acts a lot like an axon and a lot like a skeletal muscle. The big difference in how cardiac muscle is initiated into contraction, right, it's still with a calcium ion, but okay, one major source is extracellular calcium. The second major source is sarcoplasmic reticulum. But in skeletal muscle, it is just the sarcoplasmic reticulum and not extracellular calcium. So that's really kind of the big difference. Right? And there is no ryanodine receptor, but there is a calcium-induced calcium release channel that floods these myofibrils with calcium, and then skeletal muscle is going to contract. So that's a big difference, but you should be able to contrast cardiac muscle with skeletal muscle in some other ways. How else could you describe the difference between cardiac and skeletal muscle? How about just on the anatomy? Skeletal cardiac muscle is? It has gap junctions, right? So that a sodium ion can move from a high concentration to low concentration, and it brings a wave of depolarization into neighboring cells through gap junctions, right? And that also means, though, that cardiac muscle is short. Skeletal muscle cells are long. That's why we call them fibers. And it's typically why we don't call myocardial cells fibers, because they're short. But what else is another structural difference between skeletal and cardiac muscle? Kind of an important distinction, and that is, one is branched, one is not branched. Which one's branched?
Cardiac.
Cardiac is branched, that's right. So that when one cell is stimulated in a superficial layer of the myocardium, all layers of the myocardium receive that depolarization because the cells are branched, right? In skeletal muscle, they're not branched, they're just linear. And that's because we don't want to excite a whole muscle at one particular time, unlike the heart. Okay, that takes us to our third kind of muscle, which is smooth muscle. And when we look at smooth muscle, we do not see striations, so there is something missing. What are we missing in smooth muscle? Sarcomeres. But there's something similar to that, in that indeed there are myofilaments. There are actin and myosin molecules. They have sort of the same arrangement. That produce contraction, they slide over each other, and it's activated by calcium, just like in cardiac and skeletal muscle. Okay, but here is the difference. On the cell surface, all right, well, here's a nice micrograph of smooth muscle. We don't see any striations, and maybe you can kind of tell that these cells are shaped like a football, except stretched out just a little bit. These are really short. They're just linear. They're not branched, but they're really short. If we look at the cell surface, there are certain junctions on the cell surface that we call dense bodies. And the dense bodies are acting like the Z-discs in cardiac and skeletal muscle. So attached to the Z-discs are actin filaments or actin myofilaments. Okay, and these dense bodies are located just kind of randomly over the cell surface. And so there's no repeated pattern because it's just a random arrangement of these dense bodies. There's not a repeated pattern over and over and over again. So it kind of looks like a mesh or a network or a net that's really over the surface of the cell. Okay? And this kind of arrangement means that the smooth muscle cell can contract to a greater degree, right? And it can stretch to a greater degree compared to skeletal and cardiac muscle. Also, if we look at the myosin filament right here, it has more head groups. It has more myosin head groups. There's a little bit denser arrangement compared to skeletal and cardiac muscle. And there is an enzyme activity in this myosin head group. Does anybody remember what kind of enzyme activity there was in cardiac and skeletal muscle? What was the enzyme there? What was it good for? It was an ATPase, right? So it could release the energy in ATP. That would then allow for cross-bridge cycling. Well, there's an ATPase in this myosin head group in smooth muscle, but it's a very slow-acting enzyme. So that means that these myofilaments can slide past each other, but at a slower rate. So smooth muscle contracts much more slowly compared to cardiac and skeletal muscle because the ATPase is not quite as fast. Right? So it takes a long time. All right, so when a smooth muscle contracts, okay, we want to compare this to a sarcomere nonetheless. In a sarcomere, what are the two parts of a sarcomere that approximate each other or come closer together as myofilaments slide over each other? Okay, yeah, the bands disappear. Okay, but what are the structural features of a sarcomere that actually change position besides those bands? Okay, it is, I'm thinking of the Z-disc, right? So when actin and myosin slide over each other, the Z-discs come closer together. In smooth muscle, what happens when actin and myosin slide past each other? Then the dense bodies come closer together. So the cell surface gets pulled together like somebody's shrinking a net on it. All right, so that's the big difference. And let me just take a look at this next slide. Well, yeah, we're going to talk about that in a second. But I have this handy little dandy model right here. And it's got a name. I forget what kind of. Anybody know what this is? This thing is called? Okay. Well, it's small right at the moment. I should remember what it's called, but it's named after somebody that developed it. Okay, this thing can get long, or can get large. I'm all trapped up. Okay, can get large. Like this, all right, so here's a big cell, and then if I pull on the string, we can make it really short. All right, so that kind of reminded me of a muscle cell, a relaxed muscle cell and a contracted muscle cell right here. Of the kinds of muscle cells that we're looking at, what does this remind you of most? Oh, this is one of those questions where there could be a lot of right answers, but one answer is the best one of all of them. Of course, there's only three answers, so it's not that difficult. It's either smooth, cardiac, or skeletal muscle. But what would this be a good model of? Skeletal, smooth, or cardiac? And I see some people saying smooth muscle, and I like the way you're thinking. Okay, because where do you see all the contractile elements? Do you see anything inside this sphere? It's empty. So nothing inside this sphere can cause contraction. So if there are myofibrils or sarcomeres inside of a muscle cell, okay, they're not represented by this muscle. It's all on the surface of the cell, and each one of these little areas right here where these filaments are connected to each other, think of this as a dense body. Okay? And as the filaments slide past each other, what happens to the dense bodies? They get closer and closer together, and that network or the net just kind of shrinks and it pulls the cell together. Right? So this reminds me of a nice smooth muscle cell because of that. Okay? Okay, now let's look at what controls the contraction of smooth muscle. It's going to be different than skeletal muscle, going to be different than cardiac muscle. It still has calcium. Calcium is still the signaling ion. Okay, and we saw that skeletal muscle, calcium is released from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. For cardiac muscle, it's extracellular plus sarcoplasmic reticulum. Let's see how smooth muscle relates to those two circumstances. All right, so smooth muscle contraction is controlled by calcium, but different from striated muscle, which is what? Cardiac and skeletal muscle. There's very little sarcoplasmic reticulum in a smooth muscle. There's no troponin and no tropomyosin. You should be aware of that. Of these two, tropomyosin or troponin, which one actually binds the calcium ion? The troponin does, right? Troponin binds calcium. All right, let's go back to smooth muscle. Calcium enters through voltage-gated calcium channels in the plasma membrane to let extracellular calcium in. So most of the calcium signal has an extracellular source for smooth muscle, which is the kind of muscle that we find in all hollow organs. All your visceral organs have and glands have smooth muscle in them. So extracellular calcium is very important. So again, if you were going to choose where you're going to have proper calcium levels, would you choose to have strong bones, or would you rather have the proper calcium levels extracellularly in your body so that smooth muscles get a proper signal to contract? Again, and your body makes that same decision, right? And gets calcium from bones so that smooth muscles behave properly, as well as cardiac muscle, as well as skeletal muscle. All right, but there is a compound inside smooth muscle called calmodulin. We've looked at it before, right? This modulates the activity of some proteins inside the cell, and it binds calcium. The calcium calmodulin complex activates myosin light chain kinase. What can you tell me about myosin light chain kinase? Is it, what is it a lipid, or do you think it's a protein, or is it a sugar, myosin light kinase? Well, I see an ASE right here, which means what?
Enzyme.
It's an enzyme. It's going to have some kind of enzymatic activity. And what kind of molecules make enzymes mostly? Protein. So it's a protein. Okay. So this protein is activated, and what's the job of a kinase? It phosphorylates something. It runs around phosphorylating things. And what it phosphorylates is this light chain in myosin. Okay. And the light chain as opposed to a heavy chain. Okay. So that's what we're talking about here. Not because it's light colored or whatever, but myosin can be broken down into some components, some heavy components and some lighter components. And we're talking about the lightest component. All right. So it phosphorylates and then it activates myosin. All right, so when myosin gets activated, guess what happens? Then the filaments can slide past each other, right? So then myosin forms cross bridges with actin, right? That myosin, ATPase, now can break down ATP, and these cross bridges can cycle. But remember that ATPase is slow, so smooth muscle contracts much more slowly compared to skeletal and cardiac muscle. And the action of how smooth muscle relaxes is exactly the same as in cardiac and skeletal muscle, because relaxation occurs when calcium concentration decreases within the smooth muscle cell, because there are calcium pumps on the cell membrane that pump calcium out of the cell back to the extracellular space, right? And when that happens, myosin is dephosphorylated by a myosin phosphatase, right? So kinase and phosphatase are what? How would you describe the relationship between them? They're antagonistic to each other, and one will win out under certain circumstances, the other will win out under other circumstances. Phosphatase will win out when calcium concentration is low, and then that smooth muscle is going to relax as a result of it. Some other interesting things about smooth muscle is that it can form a state of prolonged binding to myosin. We call that a latched state, okay, without using a lot of energy. So this is a way of maintaining force using very little energy. This is really nice. For instance, when somebody wants to have a cervix contracted for 9 months to hold a fetus in position, right? I would not choose a skeletal muscle to do that. Couldn't keep up. Probably couldn't even keep up for 5 minutes, right? So that's a very important thing about smooth muscle. So here is an important exam figure for you. Let's look at the graph first. We have a plot of membrane potential versus time right here. And here is like a resting membrane potential. I don't see a stimulus anywhere on this particular illustration, but I do see that the membrane potential is doing what? Is it constant? No, it's kind of wandering around a little bit. So there is just some inherent depolarization of smooth muscle cells in general. So it depolarizes a little bit, and then it repolarizes, then it depolarizes again. And what can you tell me about these first two depolarizations? They're sub-threshold, but the second one is greater in amplitude. It's closer to threshold than the first one. All right, so they get larger and larger and larger, and then this third one is a threshold stimulus. All right, and this is just shows the autorhythmicity of smooth muscle cells. It is spontaneously depolarizing. And when it reaches thresholds, these action potentials then will flow over the whole smooth muscle cell. Okay, and those action potentials cause a depolarization, which then opens up voltage-gated calcium channels in the plasma membrane. And where's calcium at a high concentration? Outside the cell. So now calcium can rush inside the cell. And here is a cousin molecule to troponin, and it is called calmodulin. Remember, troponin can bind calcium, calmodulin binds calcium, that changes the activity of calmodulin. So calmodulin then can cause this myosin light chain kinase, okay, dephosphorylates myosin light chain kinase, so it becomes an active form. But now what does myosin light chain kinase do? A kinase phosphorylates something, and what it phosphorylates is that the light chain, or the small chain on myosin, it becomes phosphorylated, and this is the active form of myosin. All right, so a phosphorylated myosin light chain then can, the ATPase is activated, so cross-bridge activation and contraction can take place. Okay. All right, so that's how smooth muscle contracts. All right, but what is the competitor to myosin light chain kinase, which is always active in the cell to some degree? There is a phosphatase right here, myosin phosphatase, so that dephosphorylates myosin light chain, right, and makes an inactive form, so cross bridges cannot form, so then smooth muscle is going to relax because of this phosphatase activity. All right, dephosphorylation of cross bridges leads to relaxation in smooth muscle. So this is a different kind of scheme. So not only is the ATPase slower, but the control of how cross bridges can form is also slower to develop because all these enzymes take some time to develop, so smooth muscle is a lot slower compared to cardiac and skeletal muscle. All right, so we could compare and contrast these two major forms of muscles, muscle that's striated compared to non-striated muscle. And we see that calcium is still the signal, but you should know where calcium is coming from for cardiac, skeletal, and smooth muscle. And what the molecule is that binds calcium is different compared to these two major kinds of muscles. You have troponin versus calmodulin, right? And troponin causes a conformation change in tropomyosin, which reveals the binding site on actin in cardiac and skeletal muscle. But calmodulin in smooth muscle, right, activates a kinase, which then activates a enzyme in myosin so that it can metabolize ATP so cross bridges can cycle. All right, so even though there's a level of amplification and a cascade mechanism here, it still takes longer for smooth muscle to contract compared to cardiac and skeletal muscle. And I think that's probably the last slide, but it's not the last slide. Okay, we're going to make another couple distinctions between between smooth muscle and skeletal muscle. All right, so skeletal muscle, I asked you this question earlier, and that is, can it make up its mind whether to contract or not? Skeletal muscle. No, because it's under voluntary control. You've lived with that kind of muscle your whole life. You know when you tell a muscle to contract, right, if you're in reasonably healthy condition, that muscle is going to contract. Okay, not so for smooth muscle. All right, there are a couple different kinds of smooth muscle. Single unit is spontaneously active. We say it's myogenic, right, which is what I see on this illustration right here, of this plot of membrane potential versus time. It's myogenic. It's spontaneously active. It goes through these spontaneous depolarizations, and they can build on each other until it reaches threshold. All right, some cells are pacemaker cells, which means that they have a faster rate of depolarization or an inherent higher rate of autorhythmicity. Right? In single unit smooth muscle, it has gap junctions, just like in cardiac muscle. So that's something that cardiac muscle has in common with smooth muscle, but it's different than skeletal muscle. Right? Some have gap junctions to spread that electrical activity. Now, how would you explain that spread of electrical activity to somebody just starting out in physiology? How can smooth muscle share electrical activity with neighboring cells if it has gap junctions? What's the mechanism involved there? Is that like a little electrical switch? A gap junction is just a channel, right? It's just a channel that allows sodium ions to move down the concentration gradient from one cell to the next. And when sodium diffuses into a cell, how do we think of that event? It's depolarization, which is what kind of event? It's excitatory, right? So it causes depolarization and it moves that cell closer to threshold. Okay, so that's for a single unit. It's spontaneously active. It has gap junctions. Multi-unit requires nerve stimulation by the autonomic nervous system. And what can you tell me about the autonomic nervous system? How many different kinds are there? There are two major divisions is a better way of talking about it, right? And what's the relationship between these two divisions of the ANS? They're antagonistic to each other. So there's a balance that's always taking place. So multi-unit is always going to look at the balance of signals coming from the autonomic nervous system to find out which one predominates as to whether or not that smooth muscle cell is going to contract or not. So the smooth muscle cell gets to make up its own mind depending on what it feels from the autonomic nervous system. Okay. Neurotransmitter is released along a series of synapses called varicosities. So neurotransmitter is not released from an axon terminus, but from a whole bunch of varicosities along the length of an axon as it's passing by smooth muscle cells. right? So we call that synapses en passant, or synapses in passing. And here is a pretty nice picture. All right, so here we have a nice multipolar neuron. Here is a long axon, and we see like a chain of pearls right here. Each one of these swellings, of course, they're not on an axon terminus, but this is a synapse, which, and there are synaptic vesicles inside these varicosities, which can release neurotransmitter. All right, so we have single unit on the top, multi-unit on the bottom, and multi-unit, we said, is dually innervated by the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. All right, so here's an autonomic neuron, here's another autonomic neuron, and these will be releasing their respective neurotransmitters, right, norepinephrine or acetylcholine, and they're going to bind to receptors on the smooth muscle cell that can either cause depolarization or hyperpolarization, or could produce EPSPs or IPSPs. And what can you tell me about IPSPs and EPSPs? They're graded potentials, and what does that mean? That they can summate, right? They can cancel each other out. So they can add to each other or subtract from each other. And so this smooth muscle cell, depending on the predominance of signal coming from these autonomic neurons, whether it is parasympathetic or sympathetic, then the activity of these smooth muscle cells will change because it will look at the balance from these two different neurons right here. So this is multi-unit smooth muscle. So the top muscle cell right here can contract, and that can contract independent of a neighboring cell because it is missing something between these cells, and that is, has no gap junctions. All right, so if there's a cell down here that's only receiving parasympathetic stimulation, then this muscle cell might be inhibited compared to one up over here that's receiving both parasympathetic and sympathetic activity. All right, so these cells can contract independent of each other. And so because these cells can contract independent of each other, we call this multi-unit smooth muscle. Multi-unit smooth muscle, because each one of these smooth muscle cells will act independently. Single unit smooth muscle means that, right, if we excite this top cell here, what happens to all the cells? Because it acts as a single unit. What happens to all these cells? Okay, if the top cell depolarizes because it has gap junctions and because of the orientation of these gap junctions, okay, even though these are not branched cells, then cells to the right and to the left, from top to bottom, receive that depolarization through gap junctions, and it contracts as a unit or is inhibited as a unit. Okay, so that's the big difference between single unit smooth muscle and multi-unit smooth muscle. Okay, the other thing maybe, oh, you've been tested on the autonomic nervous system already, but here's a good question. What kind of neuron is this right here? How many neurons does it take to get from the central nervous system to an effector organ for an autonomic outflow pathway, like smooth muscle right here, or cardiac muscle, or a gland? It requires two. And which one is this right here? How would you talk about this one? This is the postganglionic neuron, right? Because it's going all the way to this target tissue. And postganglionic neurons most of the time are adrenergic. In a few cases, they're going to be cholinergic. But in most cases, they're, at least for a sympathetic nervous system, most of the time they're going to be adrenergic, releasing norepinephrine. But in glands, some of the sympathetic neurons, this is the point I was trying to make, some of the postganglionic neurons in the sympathetic nervous system do release acetylcholine, especially in glands. Okay, secretory glands. All right, I think that is the last slide. I don't think this is an exam figure, but you should know what a varicosity is and how multi-unit smooth muscle is controlled. It's by dual innervation, so these cells right here, right, can make up their own mind as to whether they're going to contract or not. All right, so that's chapter 12. Anybody have any questions? Probably not. Nobody had any questions at the beginning. And hopefully that made things clearer. Okay, study guides are so important. All right. Okay, let's move on to chapter 13, blood, heart, and circulation. This is an introductory chapter to the cardiovascular system. I think we're going to start talking about blood first and the heart. A lot of this, I think, is repetition from anatomy. I don't talk a whole lot in anatomy about blood, so I kind of make up for it now in physiology. Okay, but you should be familiar with heart valves, okay, the structure of the heart. You probably don't want to study that a whole lot before Thursday because it's not on your exam, but sometimes you're going to have to go back and become really familiar with everything you learned in anatomy. All right, so let's start talking about blood. All right, the functions of the circulatory system. As a matter of fact, let's start really basic. What kind of tissue is blood? Sort of a funky kind of tissue, but how many different major kinds of tissues are in your body? Yeah, there's only four kinds, so that makes it pretty easy. What kind of tissue is blood? It's a connective tissue because it connects your body together because it's a fluid connective tissue. It's not a solid connective tissue like bone. It doesn't make connections like tendons between muscle and bone, but it does connect all the different parts of your body. It connects it through the circulatory system. So it transports oxygen and nutrients, enzymes, and hormones to tissues. You're kind of familiar with that. It also transports waste products from tissues, all right, to excretory organs, carbon dioxide to your lungs so that you can exhale carbon dioxide, and other kinds of waste products to kidneys, which can secrete them into urine. All right, but another important part of the circulatory system is that it's for heat transfer. It can transport heat within the body, core temperature to the exterior to maintain the functioning of enzymes, because remember, enzymes have an optimal operating temperature. Right, so it's a heat exchange mechanism, and also if your core temperature increases too much, it can transport a lot of heat to your integument, and then you can radiate that heat out of your body or use sweat to evaporate that heat out of your body to cool your body temperature down. All right, another function is maintenance of fluid, electrolyte, and pH balance. Blood is very important for maintaining homeostasis of all those different parameters, and there is an immune response that's provided in the blood. So it prevents disease-causing microorganisms from taking advantage of your body. And also that immune system can fight foreign substances. Doesn't have to be a living organism. Could be a dead thing like a virus, okay, a non-living infectious particle, or maybe chemical compounds, maybe venoms and things like that. And then also other parts of your body that have gone rogue, like tumors. Okay, your immune system should fight these. And we all have tumors in our body. But most of us, our immune system is active enough to prevent these tumors from growing and getting out of control and not producing cancer, okay? And another important function of the blood is, since it's a fluid connective tissue, when you put a hole in a blood vessel, then that fluid is going to leak out. So another important function is to prevent blood loss. We call that hemostasis when a blood vessel is damaged, because you don't want that blood to run out of your body and cause a hemorrhage. All right, so those are some important things that we're going to look at. All right, the circulatory system, we did look at this in anatomy, has main two components, the cardiovascular system and the lymphatic system. Cardiovascular system has blood flowing through the heart and blood vessels, and the lymphatic system, okay, what was flowing through the lymphatic system? It's a fluid and it's lymph, okay? And we're going to take a look at that. Maybe we talked about what the function of the lymphatic system is, but for sure we'll cover it in this chapter. So the heart pumps blood through the cardiovascular system. A lot of the fluid in the blood leaks out in tissue spaces through capillaries. So a capillary is a functional vessel in the cardiovascular system. That's the only kind of blood vessel where things can enter or leave the cardiovascular system. And at the proximal end of a capillary, a lot of fluid leaks out. On the distal end of a capillary, some of that fluid is resorbed and returned to the cardiovascular system, but not all. So that fluid remains in your tissues, and we would swell up every day more and more and more, eventually explode like a big water balloon. Okay? If it were not for the lymphatic system, which takes that extra fluid that does not get resorbed by the distal end of a capillary and returns it back to the heart via subclavian vein. Okay, so the lymphatic system picks up that excess fluid filtered out in capillary beds and returns it to the veins, returning it back to the cardiovascular system so we don't dehydrate and lose all of that fluid. All right, and on its way back, lymph flows through lymph nodes and it's filtered. right? So bacteria are removed from it, and toxins are detoxified, fungus is removed, right, through a lymph node. That's an important part of the immune system. So we're going to take a look at some of these things. But let's analyze blood a little bit more. I don't think this particular slide is in your book. Maybe it is to some degree. So this is an important thing that you should study when you get to this part of the class. The composition of whole blood. There are two main components in blood. There is what we call plasma, and then there are things that we call formed elements. These are the two main components, right? Plasma is the fluid part. And if we put plasma together with formed elements, it makes about 5 liters. So you have about 5 liters. How much is a big jug of Coca-Cola? 2 liters. So you got 2.5 of those circulating in your body. That's quite a lot. All right, so the fluid part is mostly made up of water. And then there are some things that are dissolved as solutes in water. Okay, and 8% of these are proteins. All right, and here are the three main classes of proteins that are dissolved in plasma. We have albumins. That's important for water balance. I'm going to talk about that in just a second. There are globulins that fight infections, right? And these also help transport hydrophobic compounds, like maybe hydrophobic hormones in the blood. Because remember, hydrophobic compounds don't like to dissolve in blood, so they need a little transport system. Globulins help that. And then there are other proteins that maintain homeostasis or hemostasis of the blood that prevent blood from leaking out of a blood vessel when it's damaged. So these are clotting factors. These are proteins as well. Let's talk about albumins for a little bit. They come from the liver. And what can you tell me about a water molecule if you have two separate components or two separate compartments, one that has a high concentration of solute and one that has a low concentration of solute? Okay? What's going to happen to that water molecule? So here is the compartment that has a high concentration of solutes. And here's one that has low concentration. Which way is water going to go? It's going to go from high concentration to low in water concentration, not solute. So water is going to go from low solute concentration to high solute concentration. Albumins make blood concentrated in solutes. So blood has a tendency to what? Absorb water from tissue spaces because of these albumins right here. Okay, it doesn't resorb all the water. That's what the job of the lymphatic system is. These albumins come from the liver, okay, to draw extracellular fluid back into a blood vessel, right, just by diffusion. So when somebody has liver disease, for instance, maybe it's due to chemotherapy, or maybe they have liver tumors or other kind of liver damage, maybe cirrhosis of the liver, produced by alcoholism or whatever, okay, and the liver isn't producing albumin, what's the effect in somebody's body? They're going to retain water in tissue spaces because it's not being drawn into blood vessels. So what happens to somebody's body when water is not being drawn back into a blood vessel? It's staying in tissue spaces. Yeah, you start to swell up. We call that edema. Okay, so to prevent that edema, these albumins from the liver are very important for maintaining proper water balance. All right, then we have some other minor components in plasma. I know this is wonderful because we've got 92% water, 8% proteins, but there's a little fraction right here. It's hard to measure. There are ions, of course, and nutrients. What's your favorite nutrient in blood?
Glucose.
Yeah, it probably got to be glucose, right? And there's gases like carbon dioxide and oxygen, and of course there's waste products, for instance, like urea. All right, so this is the plasma part, the fluid part of blood. And all of these things right here are just what we, and including proteins, these are what? The solutes. These are things dissolved in solution. So plasma is a solution. It's a couple other things that we're going to look at too, but it's a solution that has these solutes. All right, so if we have plasma, which has all of these things, and then we remove clotting factors, so that blood cannot coagulate or form a solid plug, we end up with something that's called a serum. So a serum is just the fluid part of blood with the clotting factors removed from it so that it cannot coagulate or form a solid tissue. And some of these sera contain globulins that fight infections, right? So somebody might get an injection of serum that fights a toxin, maybe a venom from some kind of spider bite or snake bite. And we'd call that a serum, but more commonly we would call that an anti-serum because it's going to fight that venom, for instance, right? So an anti-venom is just, or anti-serum is just a serum that will fight some kind of harmful chemical that's in your body. Okay, so look to see how that's put together. All right, the second compartment in blood are formed elements. And so these are going to be cellular. They're not going to be part of the fluid. So formed elements are cells, and basically there are three kinds of cells. You have erythrocytes, or red blood cells, right? And they are anucleate. There's no room for a nucleus in there. They're loaded with a chemical compound called hemoglobin that carries oxygen in our bodies. So there's not even a room for a nucleus. But that also means, since there's no nucleus, they can't repair themselves. They can't respond to challenges, right? They can't make new proteins. Whatever proteins they have is what they have to live with for the rest of their life, which is very short, about 120 days. And then they croak as a result of that. And they're recycled. So 95% of formed elements are erythrocytes. Less than 1% are leukocytes. And guess what leuko means in Latin? It means white, right? These are white blood cells. Okay, these are nucleated. These always have to do some part with your immune system. They fight infection. They don't carry oxygen, but they fight infection and work with inflammatory processes to fight infection. And then about 5% are very, very small cells. These are anucleate as well. These are just cell fragments. From a megakaryocyte, these are called platelets. Another name is a thrombocyte. And these are the ones that are most responsible for producing blood clots in people to prevent blood loss. All right, so these are all the formed elements. Make sure you know the different parts. There is a nice and very important clinical indication of how healthy the blood is, and we call that hematocrit. Anytime you hear hemo or hemato, you should think of blood. Okay, hematocrit is a measure of the formed elements that are in blood compared to a whole blood sample. So what is whole blood made up of? Plasma and formed elements. And hematocrit is a measure of the formed elements, and actually probably even more particular, the red blood cells, which is mostly what formed elements are made out of, in what? Whole blood, which contains plasma as well. All right, so if we get a sample of blood from somebody, it contains plasma as well as formed elements. So what kind of blood sample would that be? That would be a whole blood sample because it contains everything in blood, so that's a whole sample. The hematocrit, or the percent of red blood cells, is different between men and women. That's testosterone driven. Normal hematocrit range for women is 36 to 46, and in males it's 41 to 53, a lot of nice overlap between them. Okay, so we take a whole blood sample from somebody and put it in a test tube, and we let it sit out overnight, so all the heavy stuff floats down to the bottom over here, all the light stuff floats to the top, right? And so what goes down to the bottom are formed elements. Here we have a little buffy coat that represents white blood cells, which are kind of, they're heavy, but not as heavy as red blood cells, because red blood cells have a lot of hemoglobin, which means they contain a lot of iron, which is a heavy element, so they sink down to the bottom. Okay, and then we can measure the whole volume here in this test tube, compare it to the amount that is made up of red blood cells, and figure out what the percentage of red blood cells is compared to the whole blood volume. And that's what we call hematocrit. So red blood cells look like this. They're biconcave discs. The white blood cells look like this, and platelets look like this. And then we can calculate basically how many red blood cells somebody has in their blood compared to a whole volume of blood. So here I have a nice little question for you to make sure that you understand what hematocrit is. When somebody has a low hematocrit, what does that mean? What is that condition called? That is anemia, right? So that they're not making the proper number of red blood cells, or too many are being destroyed, right, compared to how many are being produced, and that produces an anemia, which means you have decreased oxygen transport in your blood. So you might feel pretty lethargic, okay, as a result of that. Okay, so here's a question to make sure you can do a nice calculation to calculate hematocrit. If you have an 80 milliliter sample of whole blood, and what's in whole blood? Plasma and formed elements, right? From a normal individual, and that produced 30 mL of erythrocytes, 0.72 mL of leukocytes, and 4 mL of thrombocytes after centrifuging. Oh, I didn't tell you about centrifuging. I forgot. Okay, instead of letting the sample stay out overnight, we could take a look. We could separate these different components in blood very rapidly, probably in less than a minute. If we put it in a centrifuge, which spins the tube, right, so all the heavy stuff moves down to the bottom of the tube very rapidly. That's what a centrifuge does. It separates different components out by their size and their weight. Okay, so we're going to centrifuge this thing so we don't have to wait overnight. Okay, is this sample from a man or a woman? So you should be able to calculate hematocrit, compare it to this normal range right here, and then tell me, and we said, what, it's a normal individual, right? So it's not going to be anything funny. It should be right in this range, one or the other. And so it's going to be outside this range of overlap, okay, which is 41 to 46. So it's going to be outside that overlap range. So just make sure that you can calculate a hematocrit and see me or your lab instructors if you want to check your answer, okay, sometime. Okay, plasma proteins. Three types of plasma proteins. Here we talked about albumins already. It creates osmotic pressure. It helps draw interstitial fluid back into capillaries at the distal end of the capillary. That prevents edema in most people. So if there is a decrease in albumin or liver damage, then that's one of the effects of that particular pathology. Somebody will be swollen. Globulins carry lipids. Gamma globulins are antibodies. They fight infection. And here's a clotting factor, fibrinogen. Okay, it can be converted to fibrin. And there's something important about this term. When you see a word, fibrinogen, or any kind of word, and it has an O-gen at the end of it as a suffix, then we know that it is a compound that is inactive, but it can be converted into an active form very quickly by some kind of enzymatic activity. So fibrin is the active form, fibrinogen is the inactive form. But in order to make a protein, what does your body have to do? In order to make a protein. Say, for instance, and fibrin is important because it's going to prevent blood loss. Okay, so you need a lot of this protein in your body. But what does your body have to do in order to make a protein? Can it make proteins in just a split second? No. How many step process is it to make a protein? It's a two-step process. What's the first step? Transcription. What's the second step? Translation, and they occur in different parts of the cell, so it's a time-consuming process, right, that might take a week in order to make enough fibrin to prevent blood loss in a blood vessel to preserve your life, and maybe you don't have 2 weeks to do that. So what has evolution figured out? How to make a lot of fibrin, but put it in your blood as an inactive chemical that can be converted very rapidly into an active form to save your life. So anytime you see a word with an O-gen as a suffix, you should know it's inactive, but can be converted very quickly through some kind of enzymatic activity. All right, we also defined serum already, so I don't want to go over that one. So fibrinogen, you should know, is a reservoir of fibrin that's in your body that can prevent blood loss at a second's notice, and it's a protein. Okay, the formed elements, we got red blood cells, white blood cells, and thrombocytes. What did I not say about this? Okay, a red blood cell right here does not have mitochondria, but it still requires ATP for certain functions. How can it make ATP without mitochondria? Oh, I should make this an extra credit question. How can you make ATP without mitochondria? Everybody in here knows that, but don't say it out loud. Think about that for a second. Who could verbalize why a red blood cell can make ATP even without mitochondria? I'll give you a hint. Because mitochondria need oxygen. Okay, so what kind of process can make ATP without oxygen? Glycolysis can. That's right. So these little bags right here, these erythrocytes, have glycolytic enzymes in them. So glycolysis can operate even under anaerobic conditions because they don't need oxygen. Can make a little bit of ATP through glycolysis. Okay. Each red blood cell contains almost 300 million hemoglobin molecules, and each hemoglobin can carry 4 oxygen, so you can multiply that together to figure out how much oxygen each one of these red blood cells can carry. And the lifespan of a red blood cell is so short that you lose a bunch every second. Does anybody have a good ballpark understanding of how many red blood cells are recycled or die in your body every second? Okay. And it's about 2 million. So 2 million blood cells die every second in your body. Your liver helps recycle these components. And when you run out of, when you run low on red blood cells, what do we call that? We just sort of talked about that. Anemia, right? So if 2 million are dying in your body every second, how many does your body have to build so you don't become anemic? Yeah, about the same number, right? 2 million. Okay, so that's how many are produced every day. About 300 billion red blood cells are produced every day because you lose about 2 million every second. So that's a very important process. Does anybody remember from anatomy what tissue produces red blood cells? It's bone marrow, but a special kind of bone marrow. It's called red bone marrow. Red bone marrow is important for reproducing those red blood cells all the time. Okay, leukocytes are shapeshifters. They can change their shape via diapedesis, so they can squeeze between fenestrations and capillaries. Those are the holes within capillaries that make them leaky, right? And they can crawl around in tissues. When a monocyte in the blood leaves, it becomes a macrophage in a tissue. It's the exact same kind of cell. All right, so here's a monocyte. When it leaves the blood, it becomes a macrophage. All right, so I don't think I'm going to talk too much about these different kinds of white blood cells, except for the following right here. Monocytes become macrophages, so they work by phagocytosis in tissues, looking for tumor cells and bacteria and viruses. Lymphocytes, on the other hand, and maybe from anatomy you could remember how to recognize some of these cells. Lymphocytes are important because they can produce antibodies. They can make compounds that can attach to foreign substances or foreign cells inside your body, and when they do that, then they cause the lysis of those cells. Okay, so lymphocytes are important for producing antibodies. Monocytes work by phagocytosis. So two generally different kinds of ways of doing that. Okay, platelets. We're going to take a look at some of these. They live even shorter compared to red blood cells. They release serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter, but in this case it's not a neurotransmitter because a platelet is not a neuron. Serotonin can act as a vasodilator or vasoconstrictor in different parts of the body, but in response to a damage to a blood vessel, platelets release serotonin to cause vasoconstriction. And when a blood vessel becomes vasoconstricted, then that will reduce blood flow to it. And then if there's a hole in that blood vessel, will reduce blood loss as well. Okay. All right. Hematopoiesis is a term for making new red blood cells. Leukopoiesis would be a term that describes the production of new white blood cells. Actually, hematopoiesis probably maybe is a general form for making any kind of blood tissue, whether it's white or red. Okay, this is the formation of blood cells from stem cells and bone marrow. So it's a myeloid tissue, in particular red bone marrow, and some lymphatic tissue. Okay, hematopoiesis, erythropoiesis. Yeah, erythropoiesis is the term specifically for the formation of red blood cells. Leukopoiesis is the term specifically for the control and production of white blood cells. Erythropoiesis is stimulated by a hormone called erythropoietin, and it comes from the kidney. So that's sort of interesting that the kidney has an important cardiovascular function. In hospitals, we just call this stuff EPO, but it has some interesting connotations. EPO is sort of like a trade name from erythropoietin from the kidney. So if somebody is anemic and we want to stimulate their red bone marrow to produce more red blood cells, they just get a shot of erythropoietin. But today, okay, they don't get it from a horse, erythropoietin from a horse or a cow or some other kind of organism. They get actually a human form of erythropoietin. And EPO is a genetically engineered form. So bacteria were transformed with a human gene. The bacteria took up a human gene, and now all day long these bacteria are producing the exact human form of the erythropoietin, which then somebody can just suck out of a test tube where these bacteria are growing and inject that into somebody, and they have an exact duplicate of the hormone that's produced in their body. And it's really cheap to make erythropoietin this way. All right, you don't have to feed bacteria hay and all kinds of stuff like that, and you don't have to milk a cow every day just to make it healthy either, right? So it's a lot easier to do this from a bacterial source than from a vertebrate source somewhere. So EPO is a genetically modified form of erythropoietin. Leukopoiesis is controlled by cytokines. These are autocrine regulators secreted by the immune system. And I think you're going to have to get into microbiology to know something about these cytokines. We don't talk a whole lot about it here. But we talked about erythropoiesis in terms of how many cells are needed every second in the body because of their lifespan. Okay, old red blood cells are removed from the blood by phagocytic cells in the liver and the spleen and even red bone marrow. And the components of red blood cells then are recycled back so that new erythrocytes can be produced. Okay, let's take a look at this figure first, and then I might have to draw something on the board. Depending on what's here, I have to draw something on the board. Okay, so the control system for erythropoiesis, would you think, is maintained by a positive feedback loop or a negative feedback loop? Negative feedback loop maintains oxygen levels and red blood cells at a set point that is suitable to support life. So let's start with, and how is a feedback loop always initiated? With a stimulus. Here's the stimulus. Low blood oxygen is a stimulus. Okay, and there are some organs that can sense low blood oxygen, namely the liver and the kidney. I mentioned the kidney before, and to a lesser extent, the liver. And when there is low blood oxygen, these organs will release a hormone into the blood that we call erythropoietin. And why do you think of this as a hormone? Because it travels in the blood, right? And where does erythropoietin go when it's in the blood? Everywhere, right? It just travels everywhere where the blood goes. So it's in the bloodstream, gets to another capillary in bone marrow where it can diffuse out, all right, and it can stimulate red blood cells to produce or to increase the production of red blood cells. And what's the job of a red blood cell? Carries oxygen, right? So that increases oxygen carrying capacity of the blood. And how does that relate to the initial stimulus, which was low blood oxygen? It subtracts from the initial stimulus, so this is a nice negative feedback loop that makes oxygen carrying capacity of blood right at a set point. Okay, so this is probably a good exam figure. All right, let's look and see what happens when a red blood cell is broken down. I didn't find a marker, but this one hopefully is good. So here you have a red blood cell, and what's a compound in red blood cells that carries oxygen? Okay, hemoglobin. And, all right, let's see if I can remember this. The hemoglobin is made up of two kinds of compounds. So when red blood cells are lysed, it releases hemoglobin, and hemoglobin is broken down into heme and globins. Globins you're sort of familiar with because it was on one of the PowerPoint slides. Where did globins fit in? It was part of plasma. It was a solute in plasma. And what kind of biological molecule is a globin? Is it a sugar, protein, lipid, or nucleic acid? As a matter of fact, it's a protein. Okay, so globins can be broken down into, what's the building block of a protein? Amino acids. And then what can your body do with amino acids? It can make whatever proteins it wants out of it, including more globins to make hemoglobin. Okay, this heme right here is a big, complicated biological molecule. It's an organic molecule. It's difficult to handle. It's fairly toxic. Okay, part of this heme group right here has an iron group on it. So the iron is broken down, returned to your body. Okay, and the heme group is broken down into eventually a compound called bilirubin. And bilirubin is a pigment. okay, kind of a yellow pigment. When it builds up in your body, okay, then you get a very bright yellow cast to you. Fingernails, whites of the eyes are yellow, okay? Does anybody know what that condition is called when bilirubin builds up in your body? Jaundice, okay? That condition is called jaundice. Okay, so where this process takes place is in the liver, so jaundice could be an indication of liver damage, number one, or an excess breakdown, abnormal breakdown, or lysis of blood in somebody's body. So if it's a newborn baby, that means that in most cases it's due to excessive breakdown of their red blood cells due to an immune reaction with the mother's blood. But if it's an adult, usually it's due to liver damage or maybe chemotherapy or something that's having a negative effect on their liver, unfortunately.
Can jaundice happen if the newborn isn't drinking enough?
After parturition, obviously. It's beyond my expertise to know if that could happen. Probably so. There might be some more sensitive and better indicators of looking at newborn hydration states, okay? And weight might be the best thing, okay? I don't know, somebody might know something in here. Okay, so hemoglobin is recycled, okay? This bilirubin here is excreted from the body, the iron is stored, okay? These amino acids then are used to make other proteins, and of course you need to have iron in your diet. Okay, and you need to have this compound in your diet as well. It's difficult to make. And who would you guess would need more iron in their diet, men or women? Women, right, because they lose iron monthly if they're premenopausal. So as a matter of fact, men can be really sensitive to iron overload, but premenopausal women aren't. It's hard to become iron toxic if you're a woman, but it's relatively easy if you're a man because you don't lose that iron every day. So the toxicity levels are different. Okay. Let's talk about some blood groups. Maybe I'll use the board again some more. Blood groups. Okay. Antigens are present. I think we talked about antigens. These are little signposts on the cell surface way back when in this class when we were looking at cells. Right, that specify not only if these cells belong to your body, but also what blood type. And we all have belong to this ABO blood system. And we have some antigens on the surface of our red blood cells. Okay, and depending on the shape of those antigens, then we will be classified into one of four different kinds of blood groups, at least according to the ABO system. There are other kinds of blood systems that we'll talk about, maybe one more, okay, but ABO is probably the most common. All right, somebody that has blood type A has only the A antigens on the red blood cell surface. So if you have the antigen sticking off the plasma membrane on a red blood cell, you're blood type A. So that's pretty easy to remember that, okay? And what can you tell me about the shape of A compared to the shape of B? They're different, okay? And that's the only thing that you really have to appreciate, is that the B antigen just has a different shape, and your body can recognize those shapes, right? Because usually there's a receptor reaction that takes place. And somebody that has blood type B has only the B antigens on the cell surface. But, so blood type A was the first blood group that was identified in people. And so scientists were experimenting with blood, and then they realized, oh, guess what? There's a second shape. There's just not one kind of shape. There are two shapes. And so what do you call the second shape? You call it B. And then they were starting messing around with more blood, and they said, well, gee whiz, some people have both the first shape that we found and the second shape, so guess what we're going to call that? We're going to call that AB. So if you have both antigens on the red blood cell surface, then you are blood type AB. Okay, and they're looking around, and then they found somebody without any antigens on the cell surface. No antigens whatsoever, no A and Bs. And so this is pretty confusing for quite a while, because what are you going to call somebody if they're not A and they're not B and they're not AB? You'd like to say zero, right? But does A and B relate to zero very nicely? Kind of incongruent. And then somebody had a really good idea, and they go, oh, I got an idea of what we're going to call this. We're going to call that type O blood, meaning no antigens on the cell surface. Okay? So here is a pretty good example of, I don't know if that's a true story or not. Okay, that's just a hypothesis, but it's probably really close to something like that. All right, so here's a pretty good diagram on your book, and I think I might be able to reproduce this pretty quickly for you, or maybe I'll start with it next time. Okay, so here we have a nice red blood cell. On the surface, what do we have on the surface of red blood cells? We have structures that we call antigens, and the exact structure, right, or shape of that structure will determine what kind of antigen it is. All right, and so here we have some that kind of look like a letter A, and over here we have some that kind of look like a letter B, maybe if you have some imagination. Okay, but at least they're square. The shape is different. So blood type A has the A antigens on the cell surface. The B person has the B antigens. And what would a blood type AB look like? It would have the triangles and the squares on the cell surface. Okay. Well, there's another component inside blood that we haven't talked about yet in terms of the ABO system, and that is the antibody. It's a protein. And remember, it's in the plasma part of blood. They're dissolved in blood. And an antibody here kind of reminds me of a little man, or I suppose a woman. Okay, here's the trunk, and here are two upper appendages sticking out. And on the end of the upper appendages, you have some hands. And in that hand, you have receptor sites. Right? And these receptor sites have a particular kind of shape that matches up with a particular antigen. So here we have a receptor site, which is the inverse shape of a square. So this antibody can bind with what kind of antigen? The B antigen. Right? And as a matter of fact, since this little man right here has two hands, right, it cannot just grab one cell, but it can grab two cells, join them together, and if another antibody B comes along, what can it do? Then it can bind to this group over here with another doublet over here, and then you have four cells that are joined together. And then 16, and then thousands of cells get joined together by this antibody antigen reaction. All right? And so this process of an antibody antigen reaction, gluing all of these cells together, that's a really loose terminology, but gluing all of these cells together via these antibodies, we call that agglutination. Okay? And agglutination, okay, is an antibody antigen reaction, and it's part of your immune system. Okay? It's not a part of preventing blood loss, but it's a way of preventing foreign cells from living inside your body. Okay, so that's the important take-home message that I want you all to see, that agglutination is what kind of reaction? An antibody antigen reaction. Question?
So somebody with type A has antibody B?
This is true. Somebody with type A blood automatically produces antibody A. Or wait, no, somebody with blood type A produces antibody B, because antibody B can't bind to the A antigen. Okay. Yeah. I forget what you said. Okay, hopefully people remember what I said the second time. Somebody with A produces antibody B, but now somebody with type AB blood, they have both antigens on the surface. Guess what? They don't make any antibodies. Okay, because those antibodies would then agglutinate their red blood cells. All right, so you can imagine why this is important. This is important for transfusions. You can have a transfusion reaction if you mix the inappropriate blood types together. All right, so we'll go over that, not next time, but a week from today. Okay, we'll look at these blood groups, and then we're going to go on to coagulation. And you'll learn the difference between coagulation and agglutination. Two important different kinds of functions in the blood. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around. You need a picture ID, Scantron, a good eraser, and a pencil for the test. Maybe a calculator, I'm not sure, but bring it anyway. All right, and maybe I'll see you during office hours on Thursday if you have any questions.